Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton. What is Infinite Tennis? Infinite Tennis, we're the people that say, hey, get a grip on yourself, you know? Here on Infinite Tennis, we like to ask the question, what does the fox say? And so we're really excited to have Aaron Fox on the show to talk about grips and to tell us what does the fox say. And maybe he'll sing for us a little bit. Anyway, so we're going to talk about lots of different things, including Aaron and his background. And so we've got him on the show. Aaron, are you ready?
I'm here, man. Ready to go.
All right. What does the fox say?
By the way, that was brilliant. I have tennis students coming up to me all the time, and they're like, you know that song? What does the fox say? And then they start singing it, and then they make me sing it along. And I swear this one is following me to the grave.
And you know, and when kids do that to me, I say, get away from me. So, yeah.
It's a
that's
bad
awesome.
Song.
Yeah, I think I watched the video of that one time, and I'm done. I don't ever have to see it again.
It was probably one too many.
Yes, I probably should have clicked it off halfway. So, all right, so, you know, we like to have fun here and make new friends and see people that we're casually acquainted with and call them friends and all that fun stuff. But, Aaron, tell us a little bit about you and how you grew up and how you learned how to play tennis.
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Aaron Fox. I grew up half in Iowa and half in Pennsylvania, and how I started to play tennis is kind of funny. My stepdad was courting my mother, and he would take her to the tennis court, and I'm an identical twin. And so when my mom and my stepdad were off playing, my brother and I would go to the court next to them and drive them crazy, of course, and smash balls everywhere. But, you know, I had an automatic partner there with my twin brother. And so that started us really getting out there for the first time, and that grew to us loving the game, and we would literally – and I, when I tell this story, I always say I do not recommend breaking in to anywhere. But my brother and I, the courts near our house in Iowa where we grew up, they had a lock on them. They didn't want anyone in there skating and tearing the courts up. So my brother and I, we would hurl our bags over the fence, and we would climb over, and we would literally break into the tennis courts in order to play. So we, from a really young age, we were – you couldn't keep us out. We were monsters. We would crawl in any way we could.
You know, that's a common theme among guests on the show is kind of the renegade, barnstorming, free spirit kind of thing. So, you know, you weren't hurting anybody. I mean, you didn't steal the tennis court. So I'm actually okay with that. No one was harmed.
Yeah, me too. They were
you'd taken it with you, then that would have been bad. So,
yeah, we were harmless.
That's great. And, you know, kids these days don't get to do enough of that stuff because they're being watched over a little too much. But, all right, so then you started playing, and then when you got some coaching at some point to become a fairly accomplished player. Who was an influential coach in your game?
Right. So, yeah, to back up, so we started playing tennis a little bit when we were in Iowa. And then when I was in third grade, my family moved to Pennsylvania, and my stepfather designs tractors. He started at John Deere and moved over to New Holland in Pennsylvania. And when we moved, we just happened to move in May. So it was the beginning of the summer, and we had no friends. So what we did is we went to the local tennis club, and we played tennis every day. And that is how we really got into it and started to think, hey, maybe we should do this competitively. So my stepfather signed us up for a tournament, and we had no idea what it was. And it was basically like a designated. It was like the highest level tournament in middle state. And so I go there, and I play this guy who was the number 5 seed, and I was nervous, and I was like, what am I doing? I don't even, you know, I have no idea, no clue. And I went out, and I lost 6-2, 6-3. But I came off the court, and I was like, but you know what? I won some games, and I can play with these guys. So I should keep doing it. So that's how I got into it. And the coaches that I had growing up had a great guy named DeWitt Boyd, who was in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a guy named George Zink, who is a great coach. He used to be in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He's down in Florida now. He has a top-ranked son. He is a grinder, and he made it really, really fun. And he got us to the next level. And then we also had another guy named Jack Conrad, who were our coaches growing up. And they were just, you know, without them, I would have no clue what I was doing. And truthfully, when I started playing, I was horrible. I was so bad. Like, I did not know what I was doing, but I hated to lose. And I think it's sort of the analogy of me throwing my bag over the fence to get in. I would run down every ball that my opponent hit, and I was the guy that they hated to play because they knew I was going to run every ball down. And I had no strategy. I had no technique, but they just hated to play, both my brother and I. We were just scrappy. So that's how we started, and that's kind of my initiation into competition and my coaches.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So would you say that what was the most key principle or kind of like stroke development tool that helped you to kind of straighten your strokes out?
Well, I think Jack was a technician of the game, biomechanics, and he smooth swing paths and just really breaking down the points of the swing path and where that racket needs to be. And of course, at that time, we were really just getting into the modern game, you know, so this was all sort of new when I was a junior. So that was, you know, that was an entirely different thing than what, you know, my parents had been told, which is that level, pull that racket back, there's no loop, just get it back right away. And so the things that Jack were saying was totally different. So I think that was huge. Technically, I think that George is, like I said, such a grinder that we would be out there training until we were ready to throw up, and he would always say, okay, now we can begin. So it was like, you know, we're well past where most people call it a day. We were just starting to train, and it was like if you puked, you know, that was awesome, and you were getting the high five, and it was like, come on, let's go. And so we would just train, you know, until we dropped.
You know, I have to hang my head here because I really tried a lot to try to make a kid throw up, and the two kids did throw up on my court. It wasn't really me. One of them had the flu, and the other one had consumed a very large bag of potato chips right before we had started to run.
Well, so yeah,
I can't really blame those. We're kind of self-induced. But, I used to be a lot more old school that way, and then I decided to actually train smarter rather than harder, that destroying the children wasn't necessarily the best developmental tool. But anyway, let's go on to now your coaching and who's been influential in the way that you teach tennis.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's a bunch. You know, I travel a lot and I'm at a lot of PTR, PTA, USTA symposiums, and you know, I try to pull the best from everybody. You know, I played college tennis at Drake, and when I was finished with college tennis, one of my friends was running women's tennis for Tennis Canada, and his name is Sylvain Bruno, and he was a good buddy of mine, and I literally called him up and said to him, Sylvain, You know me. I'm just starting my real career in coaching. Can I just literally follow you around and shadow you and be the ball boy on the court and just do whatever just to learn anything I can? And he was like, that's awesome. Of course you can. So for about 5 years, I was traveling with Sylvain and the players and coaches from Tennis Canada and learning. I mean, we did basically summers at that point where I was going French Open, Rogers Cup, U.S. Open. They were the annual stops. You know, so he was a real – Sylvain is a very well-tempered guy. And, you know, he connects with the women because it's obviously a different personality for the women on tour and the men on tour. But he really connected with the women, and they all respected him and learned a lot from him. And he was just a smart guy, you know. And there's at the highest levels of the game, obviously, there's so much more than just forehands and backhands. It's the day-to-day, the mental game, you know, just keeping a player out there and in a good mental condition day in and day out on, you know, a grueling schedule. So he was really good in terms of teaching me a lot of that, and also I guess tactically. My business partner in Grips, Craig Signorelli, I think is probably like, you know, one of the smartest guys out there in terms of tactics, how to set up a pattern. And Craig kind of did, you know, what probably a lot of us did. He had a player who got to a level, a very high level, Lester Cook. You know, who was number one in the country in college tennis. He basically had to learn the game in order to keep up with coaching him. And that, by the way, was all news to me. You know, when Craig and I met and I started understanding the game from the tactical standpoint, he's really big and really great on three-ball patterns. How can I set up a pattern in three balls to win the point? And can I execute them? You know, and when I was saying that's news to me, is when I was growing up and I told you I was a terrible player, I had no idea how to set up a pattern. What's a pattern? What? you know, when I was traveling about 5 years ago, I stopped in Atlanta and visited a friend of mine, Brian LeHaley, who we all know is, you know, a great, I don't know, who's ranked in the 20s, I think, you know, on the ATP Tour.
You make it that high?
What's that? I'm sorry?
He made the top 20? I mean, I know he was up in the 20s,
maybe 30s, but the guy was up there.
Wow.
You know, with wins over Agassi and all of them. But he went to his basement and he pulled out the binder, you know, with all of the pages of the junior tournaments we played growing up, you know, and here I was looking for my name. I was like, oh, that's, you know, out first round of clay courts. Oh, out second round of this tournament and that. And he was, you know, finals, semifinals, winning, finals. And I go, you know, the funny thing, Brian, is I didn't even know how to play tennis. I had no pattern. And he just, like, took a moment and, like, looked back. And he's like, I ran three patterns. And I was just devastated because he had the information that I didn't have. You know, and I was climbing fences and running till I puked. But it's kind of what you said, training smarter. And the guy had the patterns, and I think Craig had that information and teaches that. So I think those guys are some of the most influential. Oh, and another guy, Andre LaBelle, who is a coach. He runs the 10-unders in Tennis Canada. He also is a great technician and definitely one of my role models. So I'd say, you know, I've got Andre LaBelle, I've got Sylvain Bruno, I've got Craig Signorelli, my business partner, and a handful of others, a whole host of others.
Okay. So from Craig, you kind of got the whole tactical thing, and then from Sylvain, it was kind of the personality part of being a steady Eddie kind of guy.
Yeah, and I mean, steady Eddie sounds so boring.
he's
not a boring guy. He's a likable guy. No, he's
not
a likable guy. And so,
yeah.
You know, whenever you're out doing something, you want to be enjoying your time, you know, and that's the most important thing. And so, you know, kind of nudging into my philosophy of coaching at this point is this has to be fun. And this has to be something that you actually enjoy doing and that you want to do. So Sylvain is sort of a master at that, and boy, that's a tough job with those girls on tour, you know, however many weeks, 30, 40 weeks of the year. I mean, man, that's you know, if you've got the greatest serve or forehand in the game, but you just hate what you're doing, who cares?
You know, it's funny because I've been changed, I think, forever by my interview with Torben Ullrich. And Torben was talking a lot about the precious moments, the precious things that happen. If you just stop and reflect on them for a moment, you know, like when a ball hits the net and it crawls 6 inches to the left before finally falling over. I mean, you can either stop and laugh about that or not, right? Or you frame a ball and it goes straight up in the air and it lands directly on your head. That happened to my student today twice. She framed two balls and it landed on her head. And then I just stopped and I said, you know what, that's one of the great moments in tennis right there.
Right. Well, and I think what you're hinting at, too, is that that's a life lesson. You know, that's not even a tennis lesson. That's just a life lesson. And what I love about that is, and I think we need to remind ourselves as parents, coaches, is that, you know, you have to be happy and you have to be learning lessons about life. And it's just, tennis is just your vehicle to that. And if you're doing that and you're enjoying it, all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, I got really good at tennis, or, you know, whatever your sport is. And it's connecting with people on a human level. You know, people, I think, oftentimes get talked to as tennis players, you know, and just basic coaching. When the student walks in the door and you greet them and you say, hey, Brandon, how was your day at school? You know, that goes a long way. It goes a really long way, because constantly, especially in the world today, you're walking around sort of numb and people aren't paying attention to people. And we've got to start paying attention to people.
Yeah. Well, here's one thing I've discovered from asking that question is that 80% of public school kids can tell you what they learned today, and 80% of private school kids can't. I'm always really shocked when a kid who goes to a very expensive private school and you ask them, what did you learn? And they go, they say, nothing. I'm like, well, I'm glad your parents are paying some big money for that. So anyway, I never resist a chance to tease a kid. Anyway, so let's shift away. That was good. I appreciate your comments there. So let's talk about the 10 and under tennis thing for a moment. We've kind of talked about it a lot on this show. I would like to get your take on it, but I don't know if we want to launch into a lengthy discussion. So what are your thoughts on that?
I love it.
Okay.
I won't go on forever, because I'm sure you've had other guests go on forever. Okay. My takeaways from 10 and under is that it's a skill-based. It's not an age-based, although we look at it like it's age-based. Obviously, I think you know me and you know the GRIPS program and how we actually move players from the red to the orange to the green to the yellow, because I don't believe they should be kept there forever. But I really love it as a tool. I love it with younger kids. I love it with adults. I love it with high-level players, as a lot of coaches have been doing forever. And I think that we don't want to be stuck in the rut and, you know, talking about it forever and not doing anything, you know. So my point is just that let's get out there and let's do it, and let's get the kids playing. Let's get them to the next level. You know, the first time I sat down with USTA and showed them the black grip level, which moved them off of 10 and under completely and onto the yellow ball, they were like, wait, can these kids actually do this? And I was like, yes, they can do this. Give them the opportunity. Like, you're not asking very much of them. Ask them to do it, and they will do it.
That's a key point that I think that people haven't talked about, is the resiliency of kids and how they will rise to a challenge. And when you have, like, a deficiency mode that you're in and you're dumbing it down, then kids, you no matter how low you set the bar, kids will crawl under the bar, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, I say raise the bar and put the challenge level up, but then for kids who maybe are developmentally not at the same level, give them something they can succeed at and then challenge them again. I've been using transition balls since 1999, And I think that probably puts me in the top 1%. And I love them, and I've used them since I discovered, since I learned about them. And I think that I kind of began to master the use of transition balls and knowing when to stop. So it's a little bit difficult to have to go through this thing that's not so delicately developed. I'll give you an example. I was at a club, and we started with 3 red ball classes, 1 orange ball class, and then the rest was like beginner yellow. And then kids very quickly, and not by the rules, improved. And so then we had got down to 2 red ball classes, 2 orange ball classes, and a green ball. And then within 6 weeks, we had 1 red ball class, 3 different levels of orange ball class, and then a green ball / slightly experienced yellow ball class. But the kids progress so quickly. And our, I got to tell you, the GRIPS program, kind of really helped me to see things differently and look at it as a competency thing. And so tell me what you think about this. My thought is that as long as a kid can compete and maintain the integrity of their strokes, then they should very shortly move up to the next level.
Yeah, because what you're talking about is challenging them.
Yeah.
Because if they're stuck in a red ball until they're 8 years old, but they, they want to move up to the orange, when do you bump them up? Yeah, you have to throw the kid, metaphorically speaking, into the deep end a little bit so that they swim.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Otherwise, they're just going to be standing in the shallow end all day. And you certainly
right.
don't want that. You're trying to nudge them forward. And what you said is, it makes me think of what I was trying to say before of speaking to people. Kids
yeah.
want nothing more than to get to the next level or be older or be like their bigger brother and sister. So we are missing a huge opportunity because we're not talking to them as people. And they're just kids, and they just want to be better and get to the next level. You're absolutely
yeah.
right. And that's a cultural problem, too, where we, if you leave them there and we don't know, we just leave them there, we say nothing about it, they're gonna stay there because they don't know any better. But if you put that benchmark, you just by putting out the classes, red, orange, green, you made the kids want to get to the next level because they knew that the orange was the next step from the red. And that's why you saw all that motivation, which is great, And I make this my final point, I guess, about, 10 and under, is that there's a huge difference if we're talking about high-performance player development versus recreational players.
Yeah.
So, I think a lot of times we're not actually asking the right question, which is, should sanctioned tournaments dictate the development of junior players? Because that is what we're actually doing when we say there are only red ball tournaments for 8 and under, there are only orange ball for 10 and under, et cetera. And those players are trying to obviously become high-performance players because they're playing competitive tournaments. Versus at my club, I've got, 30, 40, 50, 100 kids that they just want to come out and they play tennis once a week, maybe twice a week, and they're playing a sport for a lifetime and getting exercise that they don't have the desire to win the U.S. Open. So I just think we have to really consider what it is we're talking about and why we're doing it in each space.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because I took my high school kids that I was coaching, and this is a collection of pretty much all of them are ranked USTA juniors. And, pretty solid kids and who've been to academies and whatnot. And we got out the orange balls, and I had them play some 11-pointers with the orange balls. And then, and then we got done. We did that for about 10 minutes. And I'm like, all right, guys, what'd you notice? And they're like, what, huh? I'm like, well, did you see how if you had a deep short or a short deep combo, that was pretty deadly? And they were like, oh, yeah, I guess so, you know. And then, and I was like, well, the same thing's true with a regular ball. It's just not so pronounced, you know.
Absolutely.
And then, so 10 minutes of that, they saw it, lesson learned, move on. But then what are they doing from then on? Lots of deep, short combos. And now we've got the edge because we're playing smarter. You know, the other thing is I do love the video where they show smaller kids engaged in long rallies where they show every pattern of shot combination that's possible. And I think that it's a great tool for at least the short term for younger kids to learn how to play tactically because they can execute. And it's not just hit the ball really high and far and bounce it over the 4'11" kid's head, you know, you know, or 4'6" or whatever they are. I don't know. I haven't measured those little ankle biters lately. So, all right, let's move. I think we did a good job on that, and I definitely want to get into the doubles with you. What did you want to say about doubles?
Well, I think it's just a really interesting topic right now, and I think it's it's fascinating that most club players play doubles, and it's not really watched on the pro level, and it makes me so nervous to think about the future of doubles and will there be a doubles, you know, and some people arguing that we should get rid of it. I just think that the question is, how do we make it popular again? How do we present it? And how does it become a valuable asset to tennis? And I don't know the answer to it, but I just think that it's things right now. And I do want to say that the Bryan brothers are, you know, the winningest doubles team of all time. And on top of that, they are one of the most successful athletes, period, across any sport. And it's shocking to me that if you went down the street and asked 10 people, did you know who Mike and Bob Bryan are, people wouldn't know who they are. So,
right.
You know, I think it's a big problem, you know, and I do think it's exciting. You know, again, there is a disconnect between people because people are playing doubles and what we're doing, you know, with the pro doubles game. So I'm not sure what the answer is, Bill. I don't know if you have any thoughts on it, but I just,
you know,
I see
well,
the
I'll
disconnect.
Tell you flat out that I would so much prefer to see a good pro doubles match than a match between two grinders ranked just inside the top 100 every time,
yeah.
Every single time. I would much rather see, show me Mark Knowles. I could watch Mark Knowles play doubles forever. And here's the funny thing. I love watching Knowlesy because he's got those soft hands and he comes in and he hits the 12 mile an hour softy that goes down to the feet.
Yeah,
and then the other players are forced to hit up, and then boom, back down, and it's over. But what do people remember? They remember boom, but they don't remember the really beautiful setup. You know, so
that's funny, and you know, of course, where he's from.
When you have your students there, and you can watch that live, and you can say, "Hey, look exactly at what preceded that shot." Then they go, their eyes are open, they see the light, they're like, oh, yes. And I said, that's why you give your partner a high five when he sets you up like that, or she. And they go, oh, my goodness, you know. But, you know, we're losing that. So I don't know. I mean, everything's consumer-driven these days, and there are not enough people who intelligently vote with their feet and their dollars to drive the demand, you know? But there are lots of potato chip manufacturers.
That's right.
So, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, they're going to make more of whatever we buy. So I would say if you love it, then support it. You know, I mean, we just lost our SAP Open here. And now I'm determined that I'm just going to have to go to Indian Wells every year. I don't think we'll lose it, but I want to value it. So I'm going to go. I'm going to get there.
Yeah, it's a good point, and everybody should support it.
Yeah, yeah, use it or lose it. I mean, get out there if you love doubles. Maybe it would be good if there was a separate doubles tour, because then the doubles lovers would support it. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's hard to say because I, you know, I happen to Bill Rapp, who was the tournament director at the SAP for a lot of years. I had the privilege of talking with him, and he would divulge some knowledge about how difficult it is to run a tournament and have it make money and serve all the desires that people have, and it's just a really complicated monster. So, you know, it's really hard to know on the outside what it really is like to try to deal with that.
Sure.
So, yeah, I'm dominating this. I got to shut up here a little bit. You said something about the new media and the future of reaching our youth. What's going on there?
Yeah, so, you know, when we were talking about what, you know, points that we could speak on today, I was just thinking of how important it is to search out and find new media to reach our youth and actually all audiences. Meaning, and of course I'm saying this, and I know that we are going to talk a little bit about the TV show that I just did, but, you know, there are so many tools for coaches out there to reach students. And I'm even talking about, you know, for example, Bill, do you send emails or do you text most of your students?
Well, I have to let you know, Aaron, that in 1995, I was on the cutting edge by sending emails to my students.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I was on the internet shortly after Al Gore invented it. So, no, it's funny. And now I'm like a fuddy-duddy, and then my kids tell me, now Facebook's for old people, you know. What are you doing there?
Instagram.
You have an Instagram? No, you can't do that. You can't do a selfie if you're over 50. Don't you know the rules? So yeah, I try to stay up on that stuff. I mean, I used to tell my students, don't text me. It costs me 10 cents every time. Do not text me.
Are you still on a plan where you have to pay for every text?
Well, that was back in the day. Now I'm on unlimited, and now I'm like a texting genius, you know. But, you know, it is. I think you make a good point. So, but again, why are you asking me questions? Whose show is this? You tell me about all the really cutting edge stuff so I can keep up with you.
Well, I just think that it's important, and my point is I'm having a lot of success personally just reaching my students through all of the new media, you know, whether that's websites and whether that's, I mean, websites is nothing new. Instagram is the way to go. Like, all the kids are on Instagram, and you're absolutely right. They're like, Facebook is dead. You know, Instagram is it, and Twitter, and these things that we all know about. But I'm just, my point is just that it's funny because I've been one of those guys, too, who has sort of resisted it, but I've been sort of, you know, eking my way into doing it. But I'm telling you, it's crazy that it actually works, and people are engaging. You know, and one of the ways it really works is to really make it interactive, you know, even if you're just, you know, reaching people and asking them trivia questions, you know, and getting them engaged and hooked in, it really does huge for business. And, you know, I kind of look at it like, you know, if you're a tennis coach and you are trying to grow your program, every new person that you reach, like you get a new student, really should be thought of as a multiple of four, because that young student probably has a sister or a brother, has
right.
a parent and a friend, you know, or an extra brother, sister, extra parent that would play, extra friend. So you're not just getting one new student, you're getting a multiple of four, and
yeah.
being able to reach those people and pulling them in, it's just, you know, it's just, my point to that was just that it's been working really, really well for me, and just engaging
yeah.
people and letting them know who you are, you know?
Well, you know what? I think one of the great things about what you're doing is it's a service, and they like that extra touch, you know, and so that sets you apart from other people. You know, whenever I get a new loyal client, I think of that as $10,000 because of what you're saying, you know, because
right.
they're going to take X number of lessons, they're going to give referrals, then I'm going to get another loyal client, you know, and so it's really, I think you hit it right on. If you take care of those people, let me throw a stat at you. I think I heard that one out of every 12 kids who begins tennis will stick with it. So having heard that, I thought, okay, well, I'm twice as good as most people, so I'm going to go for 2 out of 12.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my challenge for me and for other people is to retain more people. And I think, so why don't you get into the social networking part of the GRIPS thing?
Sure. I mean, basically, what we do is we allow the players to connect. We have a parent permission level, which makes sure that the parent is giving permission to the child. But, you know, they can go on there and they can chat and catch up with their friends. And also, you know, the GRIPS program, for those who don't know, it's like karate, white through black. So they all have a color associated. And it's fun. And it stirs the pot a little bit, even in your classes where you've got, you know, 3 greens and 3 blues and 3 reds, and everybody wants to move to the next level, sort of like what we were talking about before. And so, you know, we're constantly hitting everybody and letting them know where players have moved from one level to the next and just stirring the competitiveness within people for themselves to improve. So we've been doing that, and we've been having a lot of success with that, and it's literally shocking if you just give people the information. I just think sometimes, you know, as tennis coaches, we're out there and we're forehands and backhands, but we're not thinking about that component. And that is, I guess my big point is that is the way to reach people. You know, it's your mobile platforms, your iPhone, your Droid, your iPad. You know, so just keeping up with that is just really important and making it interactive and fun. And that's really it. And that's just, it's been a good success for us. So I just really wanted to share that and say that we're having a great time. And it seems like we're getting a lot of people, you know, to have a good time. And what you said also, retaining, because you're right, that is the hard part. You know, you do only retain, you know, less than 10%. So, you know, I just think that's an important piece of that. And the numbers will go up if you're able to reach them that way.
Yeah, you know, it's here's another stat, and they said that if people visit their club twice a week or more, they have a 99% retention rate. And from the 1%,
wow,
the largest portion of that is because they moved away. So,
wow.
You know, and so you're doing another thing that's going to retain the kid that could retain the family. I mean, I think the best fit for what you're doing is for clubs. You know, I dabbled with it where I was, but it just didn't seem to be a great fit for me where I was in the public sector. But I was inspired by what you did to kind of create like a testing program, and we this is incredible. You know, we would get kids and it would be Friday and they would take their test and they would miss a level by one shot and they would cry.
Okay, well, first of all,
like,
Bill.
Like, it's
that,
okay,
is,
all right.
That
hey,
is
look.
So true, though.
Look how, no, but we go, look how close you are. I mean, you're like a level 2.99999. So just come back to camp next week and you'll pass. And it's going to be all right. And then what happens? The next Friday comes, and the kid's edgy, and they're excited, and they can't wait to take the test. And they get their 3, and they're like, yes! Right?
That's hilarious. First of all, let's back up, because this was years ago, which is hilarious to me, because I think that we're like 100 yards down now versus where we were. But that's right. And the key point was that the kids become emotional about it because they care. They want to get to the next level. We just launched a new app for the phone. So we have it on Droids and the iPhones. And it allows us to enter scores one at a time. So where you had that kid come and do the entire test before, now we actually enter in scores one at a time. So if that player missed by one shot, they can come back tomorrow and they can just do that one shot to move to the next level. So
no, I want more misery. I'm sorry. I like the misery. Yeah.
You're a torturer. But
no, you know what's funny? I mean, I don't know. It's just a little too instantaneous. No, you can't, you know, if you can't do that. You can't take your USPTA test again the next weekend. You got to wait 6 weeks, you know? Come on now.
Well, these,
so I don't know. I do like the fact that they, you know, because, you know, another great benefit of what you offer is that there are ever-increasing challenges to different levels of success, and it's based on competency and knowledge of the whole game rather than can I run faster than a lot of people and hit the ball deep down the middle one more time, which ultimately is not really going to help them. All right, let's shift gears here again because the way it goes here is I get to make a comment, you don't get to answer, and then I change the subject. I've been doing that a lot lately. It's a lot of fun for me. All right. So physical literacies. And then after that, then we're going to talk about the show that people need to watch.
Awesome. So I think that with the experience, you know, of collecting data and statistics over the last 6 years, it's been shocking. And primarily, the kids are lacking the building blocks, and I'm talking 4 to 10-year-olds, 4 to 12-year-olds are so lacking in the building blocks of physical literacy, it's not even funny. So at some point here, we will release our you assume that kids can kick, catch, and throw because we all did that when we were growing up. We would go outside, we would play, we would, you know, throw the ball,
you had the sport. You had to throw your bag, and you had to be able to climb a fence. Yeah.
But even just playing kickball or baseball or just going outside and playing catch, literally that simple. Well, kids do not do that anymore. And, you know, obviously a lot of PE programs have been cut, and so it is just so important, and I try to really make a point everywhere I go with when I'm talking with parents, is that your kid, before they serve, better be able to throw, you know, and if you have not been out there and taught your kid how to throw, you need to, because it's not happening. It's truly not happening in most physical programs, certainly PE, and if we care about our sport, we will care about those building blocks. You know, the ABCs, the agility, balance, and coordination, the kicking, catching, and throwing. You know, it's I see from a bird's eye view of just looking at statistics and getting to travel around and visit a lot of clubs and coaches and students, it's really we're not hitting the bullseye on it.
Right.
So it's certainly we got to get out there and we got to spend more time on it. And, you know, if you're a teacher, you know, doing classes, incorporate that into your warm-up. Have them do, you know, some catching and throwing and moving, just basic coordination exercises. So then back up to my friend Andre LaBelle. When I was young, and he's one of the Tennis Canada coaches, which, by the way, sorry to back up again, but you know Nestor and Knowles are Canadian, so I have to draw that connection for you. Where I got all my double tactics is from those guys.
Yeah.
Well,
hey,
but, you know,
do you know why Canadians talk like this?
Like
it's because they don't want their lips to get frozen together. Yeah, because, you know, if you open your mouth too much when you're talking, your lips could get frozen together, eh? So you have to be really careful there. So, all right. So, yeah, no, it's really interesting. I think the Canadians do a fantastic job of teaching tactics and all that great stuff. Who's that guy who was the Davis Cup coach? He was like a 4.0 player, and he was a genius coach. What was that guy's name? Shoot. But he was the Davis Cup coach for many years, and a genius coach, awesome guy. And I can't remember his name to save my life. But, Yeah, I've always admired the Canadian approach. Very intelligent, well.
And Andre, to my point about just the physical literacy, when I was young and I was starting out, and I said, "Oh, listen, what would you do if you've got kids and you just had to pick something? What would you focus on?" And his answer was, "Just make them great athletes. Put them in off balance situations and make them kick and catch and throw and do all those things." So, and he was right. Turns out he was more than right, because simple things, basic things of throwing and catching, they're just not there. So
you can't hit it if you're not there to hit it. Yeah. I mean, you have to get there. So, it's funny. I have a story that kind of relates to what you're talking about. The spider run, you start in the middle and you run to each corner of the big rectangle, right?
Of course.
That,
yeah.
Or 10 direction changes. I started doing that, and then started timing the kids, and my goal was to get them to do it to the USTA standard of a nationally ranked player. So I did that, and I had two kids that could do it under 16 seconds. The next year, I had 9 kids who could do it 16 seconds. Some kids did it in 14.9, 15, 15.1, and then you know what? Nobody in the league could hit a winner against my team.
That's awesome.
Winners went down, and intimidation went up. So, I'm totally in agreement with you that first working with them as athletes is really terrific. So, hey, we're getting kind of towards the end, but I want you to, if you could talk about the show and explain, what is it and why should people watch, and then we can do like a little wrap-up here of kind of what were the main points of our talk. So what's going on the Tennis Channel?
Yeah, I'm so excited about it. It is Grips Challenge, and it premiered last Saturday on Tennis Channel, and there's a couple more reruns, which I will tell you about. But basically what it is, we've been doing Grips Challenge. Well, we renamed it from Grips Program to Grips Challenge, and we've been doing this for years, and there are a couple different, pieces of what we do, which is the knowledge portion. We do a skills portion, and, although we don't actually track the competition because kids are competing anyway, we understand that that's an arm of the development. So we always have been doing this and loved it, and the idea just, came on me, we should do a game show. So what we did is we created the first ever game show for tennis, and it is like other game shows morphed into, one for tennis, where the first round is like Family Feud, and they're buzzing in and they're doing trivia questions, which covers our knowledge. The second round is physical literacies, which are just crazy and just fun and just off the wall, but they're for your physical skills. Those challenges are the second round, and then the third round is the tennis competition. And we actually used the red ball on the 36-foot court. And in our first episode, we had two families. We had a family from the Paseo Club in Valencia, California, and a family from the Malibu Racquet Club, which is where we shot the show.
I'm telling you,
oh, my God, was it a blast. It was so much fun because we were just out there, putting it into a game format just made it so fun. And you'll see on the show when they answer a trivia question right, they're high-fiving each other. And if they miss, their hands are on their head, just like, and they're just carrying. And it's fun. And that's kind of my point, I think. Maybe my whole theme for the whole conversation is speaking to people on a human level. I'm not going to tell you all the things that we did on the show because you're going to have to watch. But doing simple things to get people to smile and have fun, a little bit of competitiveness, really goes a long way. So, I'm excited about it. As I said, it did premiere last Saturday. And, the Australian Open is going on right now, so a lot of people are tuning into Tennis Channel, which is really great. Let me pull it up here. I'll tell you when our – we've got an episode on a rerun on tonight.
Okay.
It will be on at 10 p.m. Pacific time. We have
Pacific, so that's 1 a.m. Eastern, so set your TiVo or your DVR or whatever you want to call it.
We've got two more. We've got Saturday at 11:30 p.m. Pacific, 2:30 Eastern, and we've got Sunday at, let's see, it's 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern. And so some of those that are at the nighttime, the Australian Open is going on, so some people will be up catching the tennis. So make sure to check it out if you are, or on Sunday, you got a nice lunchtime spot.
What age kids are in that thing?
Well, the show is families. We've got a mom and a dad, and we've got
two kids,
11-year-olds. The kids are 7 and 11 on both families.
Okay. So you know what? I'm thinking it would be really fun for a family to show that to kids who are under the age of 11 and maybe even a little bit younger, because then, like, if you show that to your 5-year-old, now your 5-year-old aspires to be on that show at some point. I want to go on the Grips Challenge. You want to do that? Yeah, I want to do that. Right? So
absolutely.
You can bait the hook. Bait the hook. So I have an idea for you for level 5. So because at some point you're going to have to take it up a notch, right? Rollerball.
What's rollerball?
Rollerball? Oh man, it's this brutal sport in a science fiction movie from the 70s, where they combine motorcycle racing with football with roller derby. And sorry, I lost you. But they made a remake. They made a schlocky remake lately. Most of the listeners probably know exactly what I'm talking about. So go ahead and get on the wiki and go rollerball.
All right, I'll check it out.
Yeah, you got to check it out. It's precious. You're gonna love it, I'm sure. So all right. So now, yeah. So the theme of the show here why don't you go a little bit more on to some things about this, you know, talking to people as, you know, talking to them as people instead of just as a tennis player, and then we'll call that a wrap.
I mean, absolutely. I think you and I have had the conversation of people like your show because we're having a conversation. And just on a human level, in a very busy world of emails and phone calls and texts and never looking up from my phone, you know, and you see people walking down the street, you know, looking down at their phone and not actually looking up, it's nice to have a human connection. And we have a real opportunity when a student comes to the tennis court to create that, you know, that interaction, that human connection. And I think that is probably our greatest retention tool. And so, you know, we have to remember to continue to do that. And the other piece of that is just, you know, as I was talking about the show, is that, you know what, people want to have fun. People want to enjoy what they're doing. So if you step out there in a group and you are for 60 minutes talking about the swing path on the backhand, inside out, return to serve, you lost them. So, you know, it's got to be fun. It's got to be something that they want to come back to and do every day. And if they're asking, if it's a kid, they're asking their mom and dad, when's tennis again, you know? So while our education is a fundamental piece of what we do and we should continue to develop and grow in that area, we also need to just take a big step back and remember that, you know, the five-year-old, you know, and wants to have fun and wants a piece of candy. I just think that that's an important thing, and it's worth our time and attention to just talk about it and just to say it because, you know, I think that the human connection is what retains, you know, players the most.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, this is – I really appreciate the unique perspective that you've brought to this. So thank you so much for your time. Now, how do people get in touch with you, and how do they find out more about the Grips Challenge?
Yeah, that's great. Everybody is welcome to email me. It's Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at gripschallenge.com. And I will be happy to, you know, shoot you an email back and chat with you further. And if people are interested in grips, terrific. We'll supply you with the information. And always, obviously, keep the dialogue open.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to kind of throw one more pitch in there, because I think that somewhere out there, there's somebody listening right now whose club would definitely benefit from joining the GRIPS program, or maybe like a tennis center that has a fairly loyal following, but they want to grow that and retain more kids. So I strongly encourage people to look into that. And, yeah, check out that show. I'm going to tape it. I'll make sure I watch it, you know, and then I want to see how violent it is.
You know what? We may have to have you on the show. You know, we'll see your stuff,
team
though.
Of
I don't
one.
Know, man.
All right.
Oh, and I forgot. Also, you can check out the website, gripschallenge.com.
Okay. Oh, excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, hey, thanks so much for coming on the show. It was great to talk to you and get reacquainted, and hopefully we'll run into you soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
All right. Take care. All right. So there it was. That's what the Fox says right there. So thanks, everybody, for listening. You know, as you know, there are plenty of great shows on the UR Tennis Network. So check them all out. I will be going to Indian Wells coming up in 46 days, and then I don't know what my counter says today, but looking forward to that. You can also find these on iTunes if you haven't already, and then other podcast outlets. So hope you enjoyed this episode, and check out the show. This is going to air on Saturday, so you're going to be wanting to get your DVR set for Saturday the 25th, which is we're going to air the show on that date. So get on that. All right. And so now, as is my custom, I will leave you with this.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.